Well, I didn't have time to make the notes in the form that I would like to have made them in, so we have to read. And I have to read, and you have to bear with it. The two caskets, far, far away in the midst of a pine forest, there lived a woman who had both a daughter and a stepdaughter. Ever since her own daughter was born, the mother had given all that she cried, had given her all that she cried for, and she grew up to be so cross and disagreeable, she was ugly. Her stepsister, on the other hand, had spent her childhood in working hard to keep house for her father, who died soon after his second marriage. She was as much beloved by the neighbors for her goodness and industry as she was for her beauty. As the years went on, the difference between the two girls grew more marked, and the old woman treated her stepdaughter worse than ever, and was always on the watch for some pretext for beating her or depriving her of her food. Anything, however foolish, was not good enough for this. And one day, when she could think of nothing better, she set both girls to spin while sitting on the low wall of the well. And you better mind what you do, she said, for the one whose thread breaks first shall be thrown to the bottom. But of course she took good care that her own daughter's flax was fine and strong, while the stepsister had only some coarse stuff, which no one could have thought of using. As might be expected, in a very little while, the poor girl's thread snapped, and the old woman, who had been watching from behind the door, seized her stepdaughter by her shoulders and threw her into the well. We got a loaded game here, I even had the notes backwards yet. We could comment on the pine forest and all of that, but we'll skip. We'll have to skip a lot of things because I think these are lasting too long. We have a common theme again. We have the theme of both a stepdaughter and a stepmother. And fairy tales seem to be very populated with stepmothers or stepsisters or things like that. And what this means to say is not that stepparents are evil or nasty or anything like that, though it is difficult to relate to them. Having been in the position of having a lady friend who had children, it was hard to relate to those children because they're looking for what they think is their real parent. And real for them means biological and means what they have grown up with and which they've had all of their security placed in. Therefore, when we hear the notion of a step-parent, we hear the notion of a relationship with people and with the world that is unreal. In the first fairy tale we talked about, we looked at the stepmother as being something like a dweller on the threshold. That's not the only way to look at it. You can look at it as part of yourself that you don't treat as your real being. And you understand that somewhere there is a real relationship, a real world, and it is unacceptable as it is now. The unacceptance of things all of them are things that we have precipitated, including the most unpleasant things, and all of the characters, of course, in the fairy tale are ourselves. We've been looking at some things like looking at little details and such like that as being part of interpreting something that comes from within ourselves, and in this case we have to be all inclusive. And all of the step things are as much part of us as that part of us that we say is really real. Next time, we'll with the next myth that we go into, we'll go into great detail about the thread and the breaking of the thread. But for now, we've got someone who is dissatisfied with the nature of the world as it is, and dissatisfied with the relationship with it in the form of seeing it as a step-sister and a step-parent. That's kind of important also, that both relationships, that the both the horizontal and the vertical are seen as unreal. So we'll continue on from where we had our first break. We've been telling the story of a little girl who grows up with a stepmother and a stepsister, both of whom treat her very badly. And the stepmother beats her all the time, and she's just pushed her down a well. Gave her an impossible task, and when she failed at it, she pushed her down a well. "That is an end of you," she said. But she was wrong, for it was only the beginning. Down, down, down went the girl, and this is written well before Alice in Wonderland. It seemed as if the well must reach to the very middle of the earth, but at last her feet touched the ground, and she found herself in a field more beautiful than even the summer pastures of her native mountains. Trees waved in the soft breeze, and the flowers of the brightest colors danced in the grass, and though she was quite alone, the girl's heart danced, too, for she felt happier than she had done since her father died. So she walked on through the meadow till she came to an old tumble-down fence, so old that it was a wonder that it managed to stand up at all, and it looked as if it depended for support upon the old man's beard that climbed all over it. The girl paused for a moment as she came up, and gazed about for a place where she might safely cross. But before she could move, a voice cried from the fence. The only fences I know that talk are ones that buy stolen goods. "Do not hurt me, little maiden. I am so old I have not much longer to live." And the maiden answered, "No, I will not hurt you. Fear nothing." And then, seeking a spot where the clematis grew less thickly than in other places, she jumped lightly over. "May all go well with thee," said the fence, as the little girl walked on. She soon left the meadow and turned into a path which ran between two flowery hedges. Right in front of her stood an oven, and through its open door she could see a pile of white loaves. "Eat as many as you like, but do me no harm, little maiden," cried the oven. And the maiden told her to fear nothing, for she never hurt anything and was very grateful for the oven's kindness in giving her such a beautiful loaf. When she had finished it down to the last crumb, she shut the oven door and said, "Good morning." "May all go well with thee," said the oven as the little girl walked on. By and by, she became very thirsty, and seeing a cow with a milk pail hanging on her horn, turned towards her. "Milk me and drink me as much as you will, little maiden," cried the cow, "but be sure you spill none on the ground, and do me no harm, for I have never harmed anyone." "Nor I," answered the girl, "fear nothing." So she sat down and milked till the pail was nearly full. Then she drank all except a little drop at the bottom. "Now throw any that is left over my hooves and hang the pail on my horns again," said the cow. And she did as she was bid, and kissed the cow on her forehead and went on her way. All right. We have the situation that is probably the most humiliating of all to the part of ourselves that we could identify with as the stepmother. And that is that even the evil and that with bad intentions serves the good, such that when there are all of the machinations of our lower nature, our desire nature, and our scheming mind, as clever as we are and how much we hide them even from ourselves, they all get co-opted by something much greater. So that when you start studying your Freudian slips, your symptomatic actions, and you see that you have all of these sneaky things that you're trying to do. Like I notice, for example, if I'm walking down a hall in something like a large building and there's a very pretty secretary sitting there, for some reason unknown to me, somehow my foot will slap down and it'll make just a little more noise than normal. And there will be an invisible communication, and then I'll be terribly embarrassed because I'll know that something inside of me is very cunning in having some unconscious control of what's going on in me. But beyond that is something that allows us even our folly and allows us even our petty little tricks, and it turns all of them into something positive. So even though the stepmother would throw her down the well, it works all to her good, and it turns out it's almost something like a vacation, at least to begin with. Now we have a new image, and it's a really beautiful image, and that is one that we will only give one or two very simple little interpretations of. Let me just stay with one. A well always represents an opening. It represents an opening between two worlds. And it's an opening that, because a well is made by humans, it means something that isn't happening naturally. It's something that occurs. And that is to say that a well represents a passageway between two worlds, or between two states of consciousness, or between two parts of our own being that we have created by our own activity. And that activity represents sort of a breakthrough place. It's very rare that we come to a general increase in consciousness. It seems that we have to first specialize. And when we make a specialized or pointed effort to make a breakthrough, we get to the other side at least in part. And so everything from a vortex, a spiral vortex in our aura, all the way to a star itself represents a breakthrough or a pinprick into another realm. All of our senses have developed in this way. We choose one area that we find of interest to us or that is important to us even for our continued existence, and when we focus on that, gradually we make a breakthrough into the reality that causes the conditions that require us to change. Okay, now it's really interesting. I was almost going to look it all up, but I didn't have the time, and as usual I got caught into fits of laziness. But the story where she finds herself in this inner world, where she describes the trees and flowers and such like that are more beautiful than they are even at her own home area in the mountains. It's really interesting if you took this description and laid it aside alongside the description of Chief Crazy Horse. Chief Crazy Horse was called Chief Crazy Horse because he said when he fasted for days, he would have dreams or trances. And in these dreams or trances, his horse would be with him, but its legs would wibble wobble every way, and he could go in all sorts of dimensions. And he planned all of his battles as well as everything else that he did in life according to these states. And he called this the real world because the colors in that world were the real colors, and the things that existed in that state had a greater reality than the things in this state. And with that reality, he could see through things and he could lay his plans with the uncanny assurity. If we look in some of the stories that Plato tells, we find descriptions that are exactly like the descriptions of Crazy Horse and like the description of the little girls, only hers isn't even as lucid as the other two, where he's talking about what it's like to be out of the body and to be in the spiritual worlds where things have a greater reality, especially the colors, and everything stands out that much more. So we have evidence right away that our heroine is indeed following some kind of initiate path, and she's having knowledge or experience or living in a world that is other and beyond this world. And she's enjoying them as never before. We could talk about the first encounter she has with the fence. This is really things in the inner worlds. I don't know how to say it, but things in the inner worlds, especially the deeper you go in, until you get to the region of archetypes in the world of concrete thought, things in the inner worlds seem to tell you themselves. And so when you have things like talking fences and things that are normally inanimate, you have something where the meaning of the thing and the form of the thing are much closer to each other. The life pours itself through the form, and the form is a much more plastic, a much more lively form that it can express that kind of inner meaning. Now, we could look in great detail at all of these things, and sometimes it gets a little strained and it gets to be a little too much. But clearly, when you're starting to enter other worlds, boundaries are falling away. Those boundaries are necessary boundaries, because if children need to have guidelines, or if they need to have limits so that they don't overstep themselves and harm themselves until they can see the truth, we as children of the cosmos, we meaning all of the beings, all of the creatures in the cosmos, also need to have boundaries. In fact, those boundaries are necessary for distinct and true concretizations within the spiritual consciousness altogether. And so when the boundaries are falling, it means that someone has reached a state of consciousness that they no longer need those boundaries, and the boundaries are within them, and they will be respecting the intentions of those boundaries, or they will be respecting that state of consciousness for what it is, without trying to push it too far or such like that. And when we reach the degree of objectivity that is necessary to become an initiate, when we have even an objectification of all of our nature, be it the evil part or all of the talents that we have developed along the way, they become very objective and they almost stand outside of us. That's something like what we have when we have talking fences. Also, what happens, she's at a state where all of her simple mundane needs are taken care of. She doesn't have to worry about whether there's going to be food provided for her. In that regard, she's in the same state as the state of the heroine in East of the Sun and West of the Moon. But it isn't just a matter that all is easy for her, but it's because of the type of consciousness she has developed. It's sort of like the transition that Moses couldn't make. Moses couldn't make the transition from striking a rock to bring forth water to talking to a rock to bring forth water. The transition that is necessary in order to reduce the internal self-resistance that is born of insecurity, we have to live by faith. And when we live by faith and don't have to worry about where our next meal is coming from, it presents itself. I think it's not completely stupid. The spiritual schools that have their aspirants become mendicants and beg for their food for a good part of their life, to not only to allow other people to do the good for them, not only to let them know how dependent we all are on each other, but to have a realization of this thing that you're going to be taken care of. Okay. All of the events in this little sub-break that we've looked at here are highly repetitive. And part of that is for children who need the repetition. Just talking with Suzanne last night, where Willie's at that place now where he likes to have the same stories read to him again and again and again and again, to the point that the parents get sick and tired, but the child just hungers for something like that. The repetitions in fairy tales, the high myths in the form that we've been treating them, aren't the way that they were originally produced. The original high myths were sung, and they have even more repetitions in them than the repetitions that we're encountering in the fairy tales, so that in each case where she has to prove her harmless intentions, that the repetition of the same notion is necessary for whoever is hearing the story, be they adult or child. And that brings us on clearly the thing that proves her way and that gets repeated again and again is harmlessness. And boy, for a long time I thought I was a harmless person. I've recently been going through a period where I've been seeing myself in a whole new light, and I realized that there's another layer of me that hidden behind the kind of harmlessness that I had before. There are other intentions that I still feel somewhere in my character, I guess, that I have to prove myself by asserting myself, and some of those assertions always aren't harmless or always aren't kind. So I guess I'm not ready to jump down the well yet. So let's go on and read a little more. Many hours had now passed since the girl had fallen down the well and the sun was setting. Oh, where shall I spend the night, she thought. She didn't say it, she only had to think it. And suddenly she saw before her a gate which she had not noticed before, and a very old woman leaning against it. Good evening, said the girl politely, and the old woman answered, good evening, my child. Would that everyone was as polite as you. Are you in search of anything? I am in search of a place, replied the girl. Of a place, replied the girl, and the woman smiled and said, then stop a little while and comb my hair, and you shall tell me all the things you can do. Willingly, mother, answered the girl, and she began combing out the old woman's hair, which was long and white. Half an hour passed in this way, and then the old woman said, as you did not think yourself too good to comb me, I will show you where you may take service. Be prudent and patient, and all will go well. So the girl thanked her and set out for a farm at a little distance, where she was engaged to milk the cows and sift the corn. Down to work. We obviously have here the clearest description we've run into so far of the old hag or the old woman in a singular sense. In this regard, she represents the Sophia, as the Gnostics would call it. It would be the Ancient of Ancients as feminine. For the Gnostics, the deepest conscious spiritual attribute was feminine, because it was that which received power from the Absolute, or that which received all that it was from the Absolute. And it wasn't just a matter of, by a masculine force of will, I am going to do this creation. That comes later. And I think it was with great wisdom that the Gnostics had that notion that everything was receptive, and it was much easier to draw things out of the absolute potential with that kind of an attitude rather than trying to jam things. The old hair on the woman is something also that comes from the same Gnostic Hebrew type of tradition. There is the story of the macroporosis and the microporosis, where the Ancient of Days sits like this looking into the water or looking into the mirror, and so that there is a triangle from the center of the head down to the elbows, and the hairs from the beard and the hairs from the hair drift down so that they touch the mirror or the water, and reflected back the other way is the same thing, and the two of them form, in effect, a Star of David with the hairs and the hairs going between them. We're almost like poetic statements about the hairs on the face of the macroporosis. Clearly, these represent flowing delineations of wisdom. These are not just bristles or shoots of wisdom. These have a spiral type of quality, and in the ancient sense, the hair in that case is a creative excrement, that this still holds the inner source of the creation of the Sophia wisdom within, and it is then seen or manifest in the hairs flowing out from it. And the brushing of the hairs represent a kind of consciousness where we are drawing or getting in touch with the wisdom. It's not the perfect symbol for using for going into that. We'll go into it perhaps at another time. And the message or the advice that is given to her is probably the most important advice that we have from the material world, which is from the gross sensible world, which is a reflection of the most deep an ancient spiritual part of ourself, patience. There are two things that the material teaches us, the material world. One is faithfulness. We say something is a faithful representation of the thought that created it. The other is patience. And if we have the patience that we can accept the limitations here and the conditions that are placed upon us, that is what makes us ready for the next stage, the stage that we spoke about in East of the Sun and West of the Moon as courage or bravery to be able to stand up to any kind of fearsome trial. As soon as it was light the next morning, the girl got up and went into the cow house. "I am sure you must be hungry," she said, patting each in turn. And then she fetched hay from the barn, and while they were eating it, swept out the cow house and strewed new clean straw upon the floor. The cows were so pleased with the care she took of them that they stood quite still while she milked them and did not play any of the tricks on her that they had played on other dairy maids who were rough and rude. And when she had done and was going to get up from her stool, she found sitting around her a whole circle of cats, black and white, tabby and tortoiseshell, who all cried with one voice, "We are very thirsty. Please give us some milk." "My poor little pussies," she said, "of course you shall have some." And she went into the dairy, followed by all the cats, and gave each one a little red saucerful. But before they drank, they all rubbed themselves against her knees and purred by way of thanks. The next thing the girl had to do was to go to the storehouse and to sift the corn through a sieve. While she was busy rubbing the corn, she heard the whir of wings and a flock of sparrows flew in at the window. "We are hungry. Give us some corn. Give us some corn," they cried, and the girl answered, "You poor little birds, of course you shall have some," and scattered a fine handful over the floor. When they had finished, they flew on her shoulders and flapped their wings by way of thanks. Nothing really a lot has to be said about that. It speaks mostly for itself. The thing that has gotten her to where she is, whether it be with a mean stepmother or now with her new taskmistress, she loves her work. And if we don't love the work, we're never going to get anywhere. Oh, I spent all day learning a new editor today, and it was vexatious kind of work. But that's the thing. We have to love ourselves and give it, or we're not going to progress along the path. The other thing that's clearly obvious is that no matter what her work is or no matter what she's doing, she always finds a little something to share. We can't progress into an objectivity with others. We can't pass into a universal spiritual world unless we realize that we can't do it alone. And when we have that attitude of sharing, that is the very attitude that is necessary for us to progress in the spiritual worlds. It seems like here, especially now in our times, we have this every man for himself, or it's a dog-eat-dog world kind of attitude, and that's just the opposite of what it has to be in the spiritual worlds. You can't attune your consciousness to something else and find the wisdom in it, find the healing in it, find the nourishment in it, unless you can give something of yourself to it and have it be part of you as much as you are part of it, because you're in the world where the unity of consciousness is found, and you have to adjust to that kind of attitude in order to realize all of the qualities of that world. Time went by, and no cows in the whole countryside were so fat and well tended as hers, and no dairy had so much milk to show. Another thing about the sharing, it always ends up being more plentiful. The farmer's wife was so well satisfied that she gave her higher wages and treated her like her own daughter. At length, one day, the girl was bidden by her mistress to come into the kitchen, and when there, the old woman said to her, I know you can tend cows and keep a dairy. Now let me see what else you can do besides. Take this sieve to the well and fill it with water and bring it home to me without spilling one drop by the way. The auntie has been upped here. The girl's heart sank in this order, for how was it possible for her to do her mistress's bidding? However, she was silent, and taking the sieve, went down to the well with it. Stooping over the side, she filled it to the brim, but as soon as she lifted it, the water all ran out of the holes. Again and again she tried, but not a drop would remain in the sieve, and she was just turning away in despair when a flock of sparrows flew down from the sky. "Ashes! Ashes!" they twittered, and the girl looked at them and said, "Well, I can be in a worse plight than I am already, so I will take your advice." And she ran back to the kitchen and filled her sieve with ashes. Then once more she dipped the sieve into the well, and behold, this time not a drop of water disappeared. "Here is the sieve, mistress," cried the girl, going to the room where the old woman was sitting. "You are cleverer than I expected," answered she, "or else someone helped you who is skilled in magic." But the girl kept silence, and the old woman asked her no more questions. Clearly, justice and love administered through justice has its own way, and she and her employer are being paid back manifold. And when we have done our work well enough, we get a reward. And this is the big reward, and that reward is an impossible task. Because this is what we need. We need impossible problems that we can't solve, and we can't be self-content with our success. Because if we become self-content with our success, we become cocky or we become lazy and we don't accomplish anything. So things are given to us as problems. And so the beginning of real development begins with trials. Not tests, but trials. Because a trial is something that you grow through, and even though there is failure in your attempts, that there is going to be a positive step that comes forward no matter what. And we all know when our development has proceeded far enough in one direction so that that direction can't be continued without becoming imbalanced, that we are given something impossible to do, so we have to call on something else. Now, that first trial that she's given is probably of cosmic nature. It says something to me. I don't know whether this is a valid interpretation, but the waters, one of the symbols or meanings of the symbol of water has always been emotion, feeling, desire. And so what is being asked of her is that in some way that she not spend desire as though it were a sieve. Presented with temptation, all too often we flow toward whatever temptation that presents itself to us. And in that weakened state, we can't possibly get anywhere in the spiritual life, in the helpful life, in the creative life, because everything that we have that we can motivate ourselves to a higher level is being poured out. Our desire nature is like a sieve. But ashes, which represent the condensation of past life experiences. It's the wood or the coal burned down so that just the essence is there. And if every hole that we have in our desire nature, which is something like a well of a different nature, it's where things well out where they shouldn't, but every hole that we have in our desire nature, when that gets filled with experience and we understand retributively what is the consequence of wantonly pouring ourselves out through that kind of experience, it becomes sealed, and then we contain the water of desire, and we then have an unsuppressible power within ourselves, because all of the real magical work has to have feeling. Like in our healing service that we go through every week, we put as much feeling as we possibly can into our prayers, because in that manner we can give much more oomph to our prayers and reach to where we need to reach to. My goodness, we might even be out of here in an hour or an hour and 15 minutes. Hey, maybe I ought to have things come up so that I have to do very scant notes every time. Many days passed during which the girl went about her work as usual, but at length one day the old woman called her and said, "I have something more for you to do. There are here two yarns, the one white and the other black. What you must do is to wash them in the river till the black one becomes white and the white one becomes black." And the girl took them to the river and washed hard for several hours, but wash as she would, they never changed one whit. "This is worse than the sieve," thought she, and was about to give up in despair when there came a rush of wings through the air, and on every twig of the birch trees which grew by the bank was perched a sparrow. "Black to the east, white to the west," they sang all at once, and the girl dried her tears and felt brave again. Picking up the yarn, she stood facing the east and dipped it in the river. She picked up the black yarn. She stood facing the east and dipping it in the river, and in an instant it grew as white as snow. Then turning to the west, she held the white yarn in the water, and so it became as black as crow's wing. She looked back at the sparrows and smiled and nodded to them, and flapping their wings in reply, they flew away swiftly. At the sight of the yarn, the old woman was struck dumb, but when at length she found her voice, she asked the girl what magician helped her to do what no one had done before. But she got no answer, for the maiden was afraid of bringing trouble on her little friends. More stuff in there than I intend to cover. First of all, we note that there is a long space between trials. And that shows great wisdom in the fairy tale, because if we have too many major events, one on another, that makes for an unhealthy state of existence. If all of the notes in a piece of music were played with no interval, such that they ran on one another, there would be no music. If all of the stuff of the world were all crammed together in one spot, there would be no world. It is as if to say that the meanings in life are found in the intervals between things. And if we'd have a life where we have perpetual emergency, our life is not a thing of beauty. It's not a thing of creation. It is something that is ugly because there's no differentiation. You don't know what is more important or what is less important. And beyond that, it's unhealthy, because if you try to live in perpetual emergency all the time, you exhaust yourself and you have nothing wherewith to go forward in life. And so it is with great wisdom that these trials are set aside one by one in great times apart from each other. Now, we have here in this trial, which again, I'm not sure that I completely understand. In fact, I'm sure I don't understand a lot of it. And but that doesn't mean that I can't talk about the parts that I think I do understand, and then eventually more understanding will come later. The black thread and the white thread represent two strands of consciousness. This is something that is a very ancient theory, one that goes all the way back to the Persian initiates, and that is that the material world was always seen as being black or dark, whereas the spiritual world was always seen as being illumined and light and bright. In fact, these kinds of lamps, when they were first developed by Thomas Edison, he called them Mazda lamps after Ahura Mazda, because he studied the, he was well aware of the Persian mysteries. So the transformation of black into white and white into black is our old friend again. The two processes that go on all the time, the spiritualization of matter by our interactions with it, by spirit interacting with matter, it raises the level of matter by producing finer and finer forms in it and bringing the consciousness out of it, and the materialization of spirit. That is the divine creativity that is within us. By projecting it out, we materialize it so it is evident to ourselves and others, because we really don't know about our true creativity until we actually do the creative work. In fact, a lot of times I don't know how I think about things or how I feel about things or what something means to me until I try to creatively manifest it. And so these are the processes that she's involved with. Now you'll note that there's another repetition in here. In both cases, she makes false starts. She goes through many, many replications of trying to lift water with the sieve, and she scrubs and scrubs on the yarn, and she gets nowhere. Those things, even though she's setting out wrong and she doesn't have the divine insight to begin with to accomplish what has been set forth to accomplish, she tries to do the impossible anyway. And because she puts forth the effort and because she actually does things that seem that they can't be done, then she gets the insight in the form of intuition, if you like to think of the birds as intuitive hits. She gets it because she has done the work and she's tried to do it. This is clearly what we're getting at. This is a work fairy tale. If the first trial had to do with the desire nature, which is a reflection in a way of the third member of Trinity, which is the spinner, the second member of Trinity is the pole tilter. In the beginning of every creation, there is the ever-invisible power. And this manifests itself through the second, the word. And the word is the pole tilter that sets up the atoms and polarizes them through the power of the word. And then the third attribute sets them all spinning. What we're talking about here are two poles. We're talking about a pole, several poles actually. We have the pole of black and white. We have the pole, the two poles of the two strands of color. And we have the poles of direction. And this is a task of orienting the poles. And the second is clearly reflected in the etheric nature. And so this trial seems to have something to do with the polarized nature of the etheric realm, because everything that has to do with the etheric world, everything from simple electromagnetic energy as it's manifest in everything from chemistry to plasma, is very polarized. Our consciousness, even in the deepest and the most subtle of the ethers, is also polarized. It's polarized between concrete thinking and reflective remembering, so much so that people who become a unipolar, that great mnemonists are not good logical thinkers, and good logical thinkers are not always good mnemonists, because they become too much associated with one pole. So what we're talking about here is the separation or the polarization of something and then being able to accomplish a transformation of spiritualizing matter or materializing spirit through the flow as it goes through the poles. Because there is yet one more polarity that is very great, that if these are pointed or laid down east and west and put in the river, and clearly before the sun, we have the pole of fire and water. We have the river ocean again, where things are transformed. If you go one direction into the human condition and in the other direction to divinity, that the polarization between fire and water, the polarization between east and west, accomplishes something that is miraculous, almost by, see, all magic is accomplished by that kind of polarization. Healing is done by a polarization between etheric flows between the hands. And what things are dematerialized from the physical into the etheric realm and back into the physical again. So though I don't understand the symbol completely, in fact, I don't understand the whole fairy tale completely, but it looks like something like that kind of etheric or polarization in organization. Okay. Oh, I made an error in there, but that's all right. We'll correct it in a little bit. For many weeks, the mistress shut herself up in her room, and the little girl went about her work as usual. She hoped that there was an end to the difficult tasks which had been set to her, but in this she was mistaken. For one day the old woman appeared suddenly in the kitchen and said to her, "There is one more trial to which I must put you, and if you do not fail in that, you will be left in peace forevermore." Here are the yarn. Every time you go through these things, you pick up new things along the way. And especially reading them orally, you pick up things. "Here are the yarns which you washed. Take them and weave them into a web that is as smooth as a king's robe, and see that it is spun by the time that the sun sets." "This is the easiest thing I have been set to do," thought the girl, who was a good spinner. But when she began, she found the skein tangled and broke every moment. "Oh, I can never do it," she cried at last, and leaned her head against the womb and wept. But at that instant, the door opened, and there entered one behind another a procession of cats. "What's the matter, fair maiden?" asked they. And the girl answered, "My mistress has given me this yarn to weave into a piece of cloth, which must be finished by sunset. And I have not even begun yet, for the yarn breaks whenever I touch it." "If that is all, dry your eyes," said the cats. "We will manage it for you." And they jumped on the loom and wove so fast and so skillfully that in a very short time the cloth was ready and was as fine as any king ever wore. The girl was so delighted at the sight of it that she gave each cat a kiss on the forehead, and they left the room one behind the other as they had come. We all want it to be over with, especially when it comes hard, and we all want peace because we just don't want to fight anymore. And so this is a very, very true fairy tale as far as a hero is concerned, or a heroine. Because too often we get the notions from heroes and heroines that they're invincible and they love doing what they're doing. Well, our heroine does love it, but nonetheless doesn't like this impossibility, doesn't like this seeming unnecessary resistance, and I think that's an important part of it also. Now, here's where the correction is. The third member in the Trinity is the spinner, and the powers of the spirit are willing, feeling, thinking. So the creative willer that sets up the word which flows as a feeling into the cosmos, the spinning is set into motion as a consequence of thinking. So the process, so we've had one trial for the desire body and one trial for the etheric body, and now we have one for the mental nature. And that's one that we all know about, because we all have these fragments of thought. We develop a line of thought so far, and then we break off. It's lucky we do, otherwise we become monomaniacs. And we have this line of thought over here, and this line of thought over here, and this line of thought over here. But that doesn't go for spirituality, because spirituality has to be unified. The spirit is within and behind and at the end of everything that happens in all the phenomenal worlds, but it is unified. And any spiritual path or any spiritual attainment must also be unified. Not in such a way that you have a simplistic answer for everything, but that you can understand that there is a unity beyond all things, and that you can weave your thoughts or spin your thoughts that are disparate and put on different topics, that you can spin them into one central unified thought. That stream of thought, when once produced, is extremely powerful. Because in the same way that each little filament of a thread is very weak, when it's spun together with the others as a collective whole, there is a much greater strength that is accomplished in that compounded unity. And so this is the task that is set before her. She's trying now to unify her mind. I don't think that the tasks are put together in a good literary form, but I don't think that the order is in a good spiritual form. That's only one interpretation. But I don't think that that's the case, because I don't think that the trials come in quite the order that that they're given. But at any rate, that's only part of the work. The other part of the work is something that came up last time when we were speaking about Susan Owl. We talked about weaving. And all of these have to do with our destiny, with our karma, as may be said. Because in some ways, mystics have always seen karma or the consciousness of destiny as a thread that ties things together. Often, to put together individual causes and consequences, destiny is seen as a chain, which is why ghosts are often pictured wearing chains, because there are individual events tied together. In a wider sense, destiny is seen as a net, which is made up of a number of strands that have cross connections. And in the sense of weaving, that is what is meant. This is the fabric of life where the many threads of thought, which can even be one thread, are given cross connections. And in these cross connections, there is a whole fabric of life, a unity that gives a single line of thought, it gives it a dimensionality. And it takes in others rather than just one, because usually thinking is such an isolated thing, it's difficult for two people to think together because it's separative. Okay. It's interesting to note that another thing has taken place. The first two trials, intuition has helped her. In this one, she has progressed so that there is now a full creative stream of animals. That is, cats coming in one after another. This is of all the things we've looked at so far, it is most clearly deliberate in this fairy tale that all of the parts and all of the characters are part of the heroine. You can see that even the animal characteristics are part of her. In this case, the animals represent something higher or transcendental rather than something lower than they very often mean in fairy tales. Animals often in a fairy tale or in a myth will represent an objectification of a given type of desire. We've mentioned that a little bit before in regard to some of the other fairy tales and myths we've looked at. In this case, the animals represent powers of the spirit that have not yet been totally awakened. And in this, they are being awakened. Because really, behind instinct is spiritual intelligence. Behind instinct is spiritual power. And if animals are driven by instinct, they each represent a manifestation of a spiritual power. In this case, it's a creative will. Cat being associated with Leo, and this stream of them being able to accomplish this, and it again seems to be done with ease, but ease after the work has been accomplished. Okay, let's go on a little further. We'll skip some of this because otherwise it's way, way too much. "Who has taught you this wisdom?" asked the old woman after she had passed her hands twice or thrice over the cloth and could find no roughness anywhere. But the girl only smiled and did not answer. She's got the vow of silence right there. I never thought about that. You don't have to talk. The words stand for themselves. I sit here talking for an hour on it. Oh, ironic. The wordy shall be captured in their folly, I guess is how it goes. She had learned early the value of silence. After a few weeks, the old woman sent for her maid and told her that her year of service was now up. She had a year, just like our last heroine.
She was free to return home, but that, for her part, the girl had served her so well that she hoped she might stay with her. But at these words, the maid shook her head and answered gently, "I have been happy here, madam, and I thank you for your goodness to me, but I have left behind me a stepsister and a stepmother, and I am fain to be with them once more." The old woman looked at her for a moment, and then she said, "Well, that must be as you like, but as you have worked faithfully for me, I will give you a reward. Go now into the loft above the storehouse, and there you will find many caskets. Choose the one which pleases you best, but be careful not to open it till you have set it in the place where you wish it to remain." The girl left the room to go to the loft, as soon as she got inside, she found all the cats waiting for her. Walking in procession, as was their custom, they followed her into the loft, which was filled with caskets, big and little, plain and splendid. She lifted up one and looked at it, and then put it down to examine another yet more beautiful. Which should she choose, the yellow, the blue, the red, or the green, the gold, or the silver? She hesitated long and went first to one, then to another, when she heard the cat's voices calling, "Take the black, take the black." The words made her look round. She had seen no black casket, but as the cats continued their cry, she peered into several corners that had remained unnoticed, and at length discovered a little black box, so small and so black that it might easily have been passed over. "This is the casket that pleases me best, mistress," said the little girl, carrying it into the house, and the old woman smiled and nodded and bade her go away. So she set forth, and bidding farewell to the cows and the cats and the sparrows, who all wept as they said goodbye. We now come into another part of the theme, and that is a discrimination of the within, a discrimination of what is important and what isn't. The whole theme in this part of the story is it isn't obvious. It wasn't obvious to her right away when she completed her last major trial that she was done. And this is what it's like in the spiritual worlds. As dramatic as they are in their appearances, the reality isn't obvious. It seems chaotic and it seems more like a hell than a heaven to be introduced to something like that. And it takes a long time to realize that you can reach a peaceful, quiet place where you can say, "I have arrived," but you don't notice that right away. So that's one of the things that is apparent in this part of the story. The other thing that's really interesting is the discernment that she shows when given a place to stay. Because really this is sort of yet another trial, and one that is more subtle. It's sort of her mount of ascension. It's like Peter, James, and John saying, "Let's build houses for ourselves here and let's stay here all the time," on the Mount of Ascension. But they're not allowed to do that. And this proves that our heroine is a true heroine, because she looks back at the needs now that she is in a position that she's free. She looks back at the needs of those who need it. And she goes back to her stepmother and to her stepsister, and she shows a discrimination that she just can't stay in heaven because she really appreciates the value of work now. She just doesn't enjoy the work for doing the work, or she doesn't enjoy the work for the what she gets out of it in terms of reward. She enjoys the work because she realizes the need of those that are the recipients of the work. And this is a much, much greater step forward that she's taken now. So she goes to the upper room. And in the upper room, she has all these caskets. And we talked about it. We talked about the interpretation that the Orphics, or that the ancient mysteries, gave to the casket that Osiris was put in, that it had the dimensions of the universe built right into it. And that we have here, that in the casket we have the ancient problem of squaring the circle. That is, finding a square whose area is the same as the area of the circle, which is approximated by the average of the area of the two squares that are that are inscribed and subscribe a circle. Obviously, as you bring the figures out to larger and a larger number of sides, you have the squaring of the circle. So the casket represents the essence of the whole of the spirit being put into matter, the square being the compounding of spirit in matter, or the reconstruction, the deconstruction of matter, and the spiritualization of matter. So the casket represents that in the way that we're looking at it now. It's going to come up again and again in other tales that we tell. It represents then the relationship of spirit to matter in the process of manifestation in a creative act, in a cosmos. All right, so we've looked at that a little bit. We looked at that much more in detail last year. And again, when she chooses the black, she doesn't take all the shimmering colors. She takes the most downscale. She takes that which draws into it the most light. And she takes the most obscure and tiny little casket. Because from the spiritual point of view, the size or the color doesn't make any difference. It is the nature of it. It is the need that something has for our light or our love. And it isn't the size or the prettiness of it. There are plenty of vessels that are very pretty that look like we could pour our love upon them, and they're not necessarily what we really want. All right. She walked on and on and on till she reached the flowery meadow, and there suddenly something happened. She never knew what, but she was sitting on the wall of the well in her stepmother's yard. Then she got up and entered the house. The woman and her daughter stared as if they had been turned into stone. But at length the stepmother gasped out, "So you are alive after all. Well, luck was ever against me. And where have you been this year past?" Then the girl told how she had taken service in the underworld, and besides her wages, had brought home with her a little casket, which she would like to set up in her room. "Give me the money, and take the ugly little box off to the outhouse," cried the woman beside herself with rage, and the little girl, quite frightened at her violence, hastened away with her precious box clasped to her bosom. The outhouse was in a very dirty state, as no one had been near it since the little girl had fallen down the well, but she scrubbed and swept till everything was clean again. And then she placed the casket on a small shelf in the corner. "Now I may open it," she said to herself, and unlocking it with the key which hung to its handle, she raised the lid, but started back as she did so, almost blinded by the light that burst upon her. No one would ever have guessed that that little black box could have held such a quantity of beautiful things. Rings, crowns, girdles, necklaces, all made of wonderful stones, and they shone with such brilliance that not only the stepmother and her daughter, but all the people round came running to see if the house was on fire. Of course, the woman felt quite ill with greed and envy, and she would have certainly taken all the jewels for herself had she not feared the wrath of the neighbors who loved her stepdaughter as much as they hated her. But if she could not steal the casket and its contents for herself, at least she could get another one like it, and perhaps a still richer one. So she bade her own daughter sit on the edge of the well and threw her into the water exactly as she had done with the other girl, and exactly as before, the flowery meadow lay at the bottom. Every inch of the way, she trod the path which her stepsister had trodden and saw the things which she had seen, but there the likeness ended. When the fence prayed to her to do it no harm, she laughed rudely and tore up some of the stakes that she might get over the more easily. When the oven offered her bread, she scattered the loaves on the ground and stamped on them. And after she had milked the cow and drunk as much as she wanted, she threw the rest on the grass and kicked the pail to bits and never heard them say, as they looked after her, "You shall not have done this to me for nothing." Towards evening, she reached the spot where the old woman was leaning against the gatepost, but she passed her by without a word. "Have you no manners in your country?" asked the crone. "I can't stop and talk. I'm in a hurry," answered the girl. "It's getting late, and I have to find a place." "Stop and comb my hair for a little," said the old woman, "and I will help you get a place." "Comb your hair, indeed. I have something better to do than that." And slamming the gate in the crone's face, she went her way. And she never heard the words that followed her: "You shall not have done this to me for nothing." By and by, the girl arrived at the farm, and she was engaged to look after the cows and sift the corn as her stepsister had been. But it was only when somebody was watching her that she did her work. At other times, the cow house was dirty and the cows ill-fed and beaten so that they kicked over the pail and tried to butt her, and everyone said they had never seen such thin cows or such poor milk. As for the cats, she chased them away and ill-treated them so that they had not even the spirit to chase the rats and mice, which nowadays ran about everywhere. And when the sparrows came to beg for some corn, they fared no better than the cows and the cats, for the girl threw her shoes at them till they flew in a fright to the woods and took shelter among the trees.
Nothing like real contrast to show things off as they are. In fact, this whole subsection shows real contrast. The most important being like the change of perspective between the inner world and the outer world. Various initiates, Max Heindel, who has been a great influence to me, describes the experience of what it's like coming back into the body. If you don't know how, whether you even really want to do it, and when you get there, it feels like it's dirty and hasn't been taken care of because you've been off doing things in the inner worlds. But he says after you're there for a while, you change perspective, and then you come to like being in the physical again. So the description of how she has passed from the inner worlds
and found herself in her abode in the material, a dirty, untaken care of, uncomfortable kind of place, is, seems to be a pretty apt description. The the denouement of things comes into a big unwinding. Everything is coming apart. The fences are going down. All of the everything seems to be going to pieces. She's put or chooses her own little private outhouse or chicken coop, we'll find that's what it is after a while, and she's perfectly content and perfectly happy to be there. The main thing about this is discrimination or discernment taken another step deeper, because we've been looking at a fairy tale that has to do with work, which is the reason we chose it. And the work that is here is common to both of the sisters. But this shows very clearly the difference between the life of a saint and the life of a sinner. Two people can have the same chores, the same tasks, the same trials, and may even do the same work. But the only difference between the life of the sinner, the life of the saint, is the spirit and the attention that one puts into it. We're in the same world as spiritual aspirants as everybody else, even people who would do harm to the world or gratify themselves with the world. And the only thing that can really differentiate, you know, it's like the Bible says, the same sun shines on the just as on the unjust. And the thing that makes a difference, we're back in the world of appearances now. And the only thing that makes a difference relative to life is what we put into it, all of the spirit that we pour into it at that end. That seems to be the primary lesson of the whole fairy tale. But let's finish it off and look at a few afterward thoughts. Months passed in this manner, when one day the mistress called the girl to her. "All that I have given you to do, you have done ill," said she. "Yet I will give you another chance, for though you cannot tend cows or divide grain from the chaff, there may be other things that you can do better. Therefore take this sieve to the well and fill it with water, and see that you bring it back without spilling a single drop." Really fair that the same opportunities are given to both, no matter how they've performed it before. We all get the same chance. The girl took the sieve and carried it to the well as her sister had done. But no little birds came to help her, and after dipping it into the well two or three times, she brought it back empty. "I thought as much," said the old woman angrily. She that is useless in one thing is useless in another. Perhaps the mistress may have thought that the girl had learned a lesson, but if she did, she was quite mistaken, as the work was no better done than before. By and by she sent for her again and gave her maid the black and white yarn to wash in the river, but there was no one to tell her the secret by which the black would turn to white and the white white black. So she brought them back as they were. It's an interesting thing in that, because you can't tell really whether the job was done. It takes a special kind of discernment to know that the white has been changed to the black and the black has been changed to the white. This time the old woman only looked at her grimly, but the girl was too well pleased with herself to care what anyone thought about her. After some weeks, her third trial came, and the yarn was given her to spin as it had been given to her stepsister before her. but no procession of cats entered the room to weave a web of fine cloth. And at sunset, she only brought back to her mistress an armful of dirty, tangled wool. "There seems nothing in the world you can do," said the old woman, and left her to herself. Soon after this, the year was up, and the girl went to her mistress to tell her that she wished to go home. "Little desire have I to keep you," answered the old woman. "For no one thing have you done as you ought. Still, I will give you some payment. Therefore, go up into the loft and choose for yourself one of the caskets that lies there. But see that you do not open it till you take your place, till you place it where you wish it to stay." This is what the girl had been hoping for, and so rejoiced was she that without even stopping to thank the old woman, she ran as fast as she could to the loft. There were caskets blue and red, green and yellow, silver and gold, and there in the corner stood a little black casket just like the one her stepsister had brought home. "If there are so many jewels in that little black thing, this big red one should hold twice the number," she said to herself, and snatching it up, she set off on her road home and without even going to bid farewell to her mistress. "See, mother, what I have brought," cried she, as she entered the cottage holding the casket in both hands. "Ah, you have got something very different from that little black box," answered the old woman with delight. But the girl was so busy finding a place for it to stand that she took little notice of her mother. "It will look best here. No, here," she said, setting it first on one piece of furniture and then on another. "No, after all, it is too fine to live in the kitchen. Let us place it in the guest chamber." So mother and daughter carried it proudly upstairs and put it on a shelf over the fireplace. Then, untying the key from the handle, they opened the box. As before, a bright light leaped out directly when the lid was raised. But it did not spring from the luster of jewels, but from hot flames which darted along the walls and burnt up the cottage and all that was in it, and the mother and daughter as well. As they had done before, when the stepdaughter came home, the daughters all hurried only to see what was the matter, but they were too late. Only the hen house was left standing, and in spite of her riches, there the stepdaughter lived happily to the end of her days. Magic, or creative works that are done by the initiate, cannot be done unless someone has the life, unless someone has the insight. Things are not exactly what they appear, and just repeating a formula or going through a set of forms cannot do it. You have to have the creative light, you have to have the creative love inside of you, or magic is an impossibility. And the stepsister has very much avoided that. There is something to knowledge, there is something to skill, but it's not enough. We'll look at the 1 year cycle. We'll pass that over as we did with east of the sun and west of the moon, and just pass on to the obvious moral of the story, that when the material world or when evil has run its course, it doesn't have to be punished. We don't self-righteously have to put it down or destroy it or do anything of that nature. It self-destructs. It takes care of itself. It dissolves its own self in its own spite. So we don't have to worry about that kind of activity. And so we have our heroine living in a humble place because she has a discernment and she knows how humble and simple her needs are. And though she lives happily all the rest of her days, it's my bet that she certainly worked all the rest of her days. Because I don't think that she could possibly have not, because she knew the wisdom and the character of that, which is what we're going to talk about just for a few moments. In the first fairy tale we looked at, we had a Venus fairy tale. Everything happened with ease and beauty and happened as a consequence of love. Then we balanced and we went to a Martial fairy tale and we looked at the impetuous Susan Awo, who did all sorts of destructive but also forceful kinds of things that were necessary to do. And we saw the negative side of Mars, but that did redeem itself through martial activity and eventually through healing. The reason I selected this is because I wanted to show that because it's a Mars myth, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a destructive kind of energy. It's perfectly possible for it to be constructive and building. And the keynote of Mars then becomes work. For the very masculine, very fiery sons of Cain, Lucifers that we are, that are interested in the mysteries, we realize that work is absolutely necessary. It shouldn't be carried to an extreme, and there's plenty of warning that is given by that. You know, the early gospelers, the early apostles, had big struggles over whether we should live a life of faith or whether we should live a life of work. And Paul settled it and said, we have to do both, that works without faith is nothing and faith without works is nothing. And so we who are on that Luciferic side realize that work is what is important. Now, the nature or the flavor of spirit is character. But that character that is the flavor of spirit is a consequence of all of the soul that has been absorbed into it. But that soul has all of its flavor from the deeds, from the work that we have done in the world. This is one of the reasons why it's so easy to confuse soul with spirit, because spirit has the flavor of the soul that is built into it. What we are in spirit is a result of what we have and have not done. But it's a matter of doing, which is a matter of work. And the martial side of initiation, the martial part of it is works. And that work is twofold. Part of the work is subjective. Along the way, we have made choices. And we've been free in making choices. To a large extent, we have been led into the experiences that we have had by the gods. But still, along the way, we made choices of whether we would cooperate or how we would cooperate. And this has brought us to each have different personalities, different minds, different desires, different energies, and different physical forms. These personalities are the consequence of the choices we've made in the past. And what we do with these personalities and the opportunities that issue themselves from the personalities determine what the character.